Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Sorry about the late start tonight. The Coca-Cola 600 is happening a couple miles away from us, and they are under red flag right now. Something unprecedented going on down there at the racetrack. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become that we thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. We got a lot going on tonight. I mean a lot. I hope I can get it all in tonight. Last week I was in Santa Monica filming for True TV. You're going to see that come out here before too long. A new segment on weather warfare. I think you'll enjoy it. I built a very large cloud chamber for this one. Now, let's get started. The solar wind tonight is a blistering 637 kilometers per second. And there are six major sunspot clusters on the sun today, with Behemoth 1756 emitting beta gamma magnetic field. Harbors energy for M-class flares. Now we need them. Without flares, our atmosphere can't rebuild. But when the geomagnetic storm is strong enough to trigger earthquakes and volcanoes, which we are seeing scattered around the planet today, that's kind of scary. And hopefully we don't have another Carrington event like we had in 1859. We are still in the wake of a coronal mass ejection that struck on May 24th, just a couple of days ago. This is causing geomagnetic unrest around the poles. Aurora sightings have been few, however, because the competing glare of the full moon is blocking them out. Also, when the sun goes down tonight, shortly here on the East Coast, step outside and look west. You'll see Venus, Jupiter, and Mercury converge to form a bright triangle in the sunset sky. We've been waiting for it for a while, and it looks really, really beautiful in the clear sky. Hopefully we have some clear skies. We've had nothing but overcast almost coast to coast for a while. Next week on X Squared Radio, we have the dynamic reporter, author, Diana West. She's the author of a new book. It is almost for sale on Amazon. You can pre-order it now. The book is called American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. It's on St. Martin's Press, fresh off the presses. You'll be able to find the link at X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. She will be on next week. She's also the author of The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. She has a weekly newspaper column, and it's syndicated by Universal UClick, and West also serves as Washington correspondent for European weekly newspaper Dispatch International. She's one of the 19 co-authors, including Frank Gaffney, Andrew C. McCarthy, and James Woolsey, of Sharia, The Threat to America, a 2010 publication of the Center for Security Policy. West's work has appeared in many publications, including the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, the Weekly Standard, and the Washington Post magazine. And her fiction has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. She has made numerous television and radio appearances and was recently featured in the Glenn Beck TV documentaries The Project and Rumors of World War III. Like I said, we'll try to bring you the leading edge stuff here. I saw her interviewed on Book TV today. We contacted her publicist today, and we've made arrangements for an interview either pre-recorded during the week or hopefully live next Sunday right here on X Squared Radio. It's very important that we bring you the very best, the very leading edge happenings of what's going on. But this is so blockbuster, so amazing, this revelation, this research that she has done. It is just going to blow you away what has been going on. So don't miss next week. Tell your friends. We'll do a headline on BBS Radio internationally. As you know, BBS Radio is now, by content, the largest webcast network on Earth, bar none. So if you want to get your news, you want to get the latest on everything from human consciousness to what's going on with the drone wars, bankster wars, everything, this is the place to be. Now, we're going to cover a lot because there is a lot going on in the news. You know, when it rains, it pours in Washington, D.C. And not that I want to cover too much political news, but these are things that shape our daily lives, not just in science, but also in the statistics of money and value and what your savings are worth, what you can hold on to, what things you can do right now to get a hold of your assets so they don't slip away in the middle of the night. We also are going to cover a lot of space news tonight. You know, corporate researchers might be living on the moon by the time NASA astronauts head off to visit an asteroid in the 2020s. A study of future human missions unveiled this week. As you know, Bigelow Aerospace is one of the innovators in low-cost, large-volume, lightweight spacecraft. I don't mean specifically launch vehicles, but I mean craft that can exist for long periods of time in space and even on the surface of other planets. Bigelow, as you know, pioneered the idea of inflatable spacecraft. You know that the interior of the craft, if it's kept at sea level, would be 14.7 pounds per square foot or per square inch. And you don't have to keep the interior of a spacecraft at that pressure. You can keep it at about 6,000 feet altitude, somewhere around 11 or even 10 pounds per square inch. And that's plenty to keep a spacecraft inflated in space. And the fabrics are multi-layer. They're almost meteor-proof, not large meteor, but, of course, the salt and pepper-sized meteorites that you see in or might encounter in space. It can absorb those. It can also protect the occupants against solar flares and other things. And these are very cost-effective, not only to build but also to lift into space. So Bigelow Aerospace, commissioned by NASA, shows a lot of excitement and interest from various companies for such ventures, said Robert Bigelow, founder and president of the Las Vegas-based firm. The projects range from pharmaceutical research aboard Earth-orbiting habitats. As you know, the low-gravity and low-pressure environments of low-Earth orbit make for chemical processes and manufacturing processes that you can't do here on Earth because gravity messes up the organic chemistry processes. They're also heavy into supplying equipment and craft for missions to the moon's surface, citing a draft of the report due to be released in a few weeks. We'll cover that here on X Squared Radio. NASA intends to follow the International Space Station program with astronaut visits to an asteroid by 2025 and to Mars about a decade later. You know, it takes a large multinational effort A lot of groundwork has to be laid. A lot of special satellites and special way stations need to be put into place in order to make a not only a mission like that possible, but possible rescue and backup possible. President Obama's proposed budget for fiscal year beginning October 1st of this year requests only $105 million for the U.S. Space Agency to begin work on a mission to find a small asteroid and reposition it around the moon for future visit by astronauts. In other words, we're going to put something out there in orbit around the moon. And private companies, including Bigelow Aerospace, have more interest in the moon itself. William Gerstenmaier, NASA's head of space operations, said on the call this week, "It's important for us to know that there's some interest in moon activity and lunar surface activity. Of course, there is. We can take advantage of what the private sector is doing in areas such as space transportation, life support systems, and other technologies needed for travel beyond the space station's 250-mile high orbit," which is where the International Space Station cruises right now. Many of you, if you go to heavens-above.com, heavens-above.com, you can register, put in your location, and find out when the International Space Station is coming over your house. If you've never seen it before, I highly recommend that you do that because your jaw will be on your chest as you're looking up. It is huge, it is well lit, and with a simple pair of binoculars, you can really zoom in on that thing and see the solar panels. I have infrared photograph movies myself of it with the Russian supply ship close in chase with a simple video camera. So it's right up there and quite amazing. He goes on to say, "We thought that this time we would kind of turn that around a little bit, that we would ask industry first what they're interested in, where they see human presence that makes sense, especially commercial sense, and where they see potential commercial markets." Bigelow Aerospace surveyed about 20 companies as well as foreign space agencies and research organizations for the NASA study, which the company undertook at its own expense. I would say, based on my travels and conferences and things that I've been to, that there are at least 200 companies that are interested in sending processes or materials or possibilities for habitats to the moon. As you know, the moon has gravity. It has a very, very faint atmosphere. It does experience wind. It does experience clouds from time to time. But the real secret to the moon is underneath the surface. We have photographed very clearly, and by that I mean not only Earth-based observatories, but also Japanese and Chinese high-resolution photographic probes that have orbited the moon and literally taken pictures of just about every square mile of real estate up there. And what they have found is a smattering of volcanic vents, ancient volcanic vents that go down into the moon. Amazingly, these are quite symmetrical. That is to say, they're not cracks and fissures in the ground. They're rather round, almost perfectly so, which has a lot of people curious about what's down in the darkness. We also have fairly good resolution oblique shots of the slanting walls of several of the craters on the moon and what appear to be garages of some sort. Mike Barra has been on this program and talked about that very thing, and if you look at some of his publications, you will see, as he has coordinated his work with Hoagland, that not only are these garages there, but they're appears to be things parked in the garages. I'm not going to go into too much detail about what they are because you can go back and listen to the archives for yourself, but they do not appear to be natural formations back in those cliffside openings. It does seem like a logical place for such things since the surface of the moon does not protect you against not only solar activity, which can be quite violent, as we are experiencing right now with a very high solar wind, but also against, thousands of tiny little sand-sized meteorites that collide with the moon on a regular basis. That's not the kind of thing that you want to be out and about golfing on the surface of the moon and getting hit by. So it's not the kind of thing you want to be exposed to on a regular basis. It could be why we have not been back to the moon. I would like to hear reasons, your opinion, as to why you think we have not been back to the moon since 1972. You can call in 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America and anywhere else on planet or off planet. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. If you must get out, or if you must watch the Coca-Cola 600, which has now been released from its red flag, and they are making their caution laps around the track right now, warming the cars up. If you must get out or you want to turn that on full volume, I highly recommend it at full volume, you can call in at 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. That's our conference call line. And then put in the passcode 769608. You can listen with your Bluetooth while you're walking around. We'll keep you posted on the race. Don't worry. It promises to be at least a 3.5-hour race tonight. The temperature is quite low for this time of year. It's going to be about a 65-degree night. And as you know, these cars love cold air. They run at about 700 horsepower in a car that weighs about 1,800 pounds. So it promises to be a very quick race as far as acceleration, and that means that the cars can get in trouble in a hurry. We'll keep you posted on that. Now, maybe so goes NASCAR, so goes the economy. Hard to tell. One of the things that we have covered from time to time is the mathematics and the very complicated algorithm that goes along with the economy. As you know, for thousands of years, the economy has been based on something rare and something precious and something that does not canker or grow old, and that's gold. Not too long ago, about a generation ago, back during the greatest generation, world leaders began to take their countries off of the gold standard. And there are lots of ideas as to why they did that. So maybe they could take control of a fiat currency rather than one that's based on something of rarity and value like gold. And it gives the banksters the ability to perhaps set the value wherever they want to by printing more money or crashing the money supply. And statements have been made by Rockefellers and Rothschilds and others that if they could control the money supply, it really doesn't matter who makes the laws or who is going to be elected. Well, in place of gold, they have placed a paper gold, a bullion. It's a tradable security. Now, the legal claims on physical gold, because of this paper gold, this bullion that's been floating out there, far exceed the amount of actual physical gold that the banks actually have by a very, very wide margin. It's not even close. And right now, the bankers are scared out of their wits. Why? Because their warehouses are being drained of physical gold. How does that happen? How do you drain a warehouse of physical gold? I'm glad you asked that question. What happens when the physical gold is gone, but they still have lots and lots of people that actually have legal claims to the gold with these paper gold bullion certificates? What happens if the people say, you know, I'd like to trade my paper certificate for the hard metal. I'd like to take delivery of it now. I'm not going to trade it anymore. I'm going to save it. We have seen, because of several inputs into the complex algorithm of world economy, such as the Japanese printing yen to try to print their way out of their recession, our own treasury through the Fed, Ben Bernanke, printing dollars like they were going out of style, somewhere between $40 and $80 billion a month for a while. It's called the pump. And we are realizing an absolute stellar rock and roll Dow, which is an indication, supposedly an indication of the value of the companies that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Now, it's not an average of all the companies that are on the stock market, but it is of the companies that are selected to be part of the Dow. And when we talk about the Fortune 500, about the top 140 companies on the Dow have been there since the Dow was formed. So it doesn't change hands a lot, those top positions. So when that moment arrives that people with the paper gold want to make a claim on the physical gold, it will represent the end of the paper gold scam. Many believe that the recent takedown of the Prince of Paper Gold was a desperate attempt by the bankers to put off that day of reckoning, but it appears to have backfired on them. Instead of cooling off demand for the precious metals, as you know, gold went from around $1,900 an ounce, it settled out actually, around $1,800 an ounce. It recently slid rather steeply down to about $1,400 an ounce. And we had reporters with respected organizations like Bloomberg and Fidelity using the word crisis in their reports. That's not the kind of thing that you want to hear, especially when ostensibly that is where the value of the paper gold, which drives a significant amount of the economy on the hedge side, to say. So what happened when gold went down suddenly, and this came as a threat, a result of the threat, of Japan trying to print more yen to print their way out of the recession, Cyprus having to sell off some of its gold, the Bank of Cyprus, because, as you know, the IMF moved in, closed that bank, Of course, after many of the wealthy that had their money in the Bank of Cyprus were allowed to sneak in, write checks, and transfer that money out to other banks that were not going to be affected, leaving behind the average depositor and even some of the wealthy. People that had more than $100,000 on deposit in that bank woke up to a rude awakening that about 20% of their wealth was going to be, well, taken. Not borrowed. It was going to be taken by the IMF to help bail out that bank. Taxpayers weren't capable of doing it, and they really wanted to go after a lot of these money laundering operations, although many of those were able to buy their way out of the situation or bribe their way out of the situation. A lot of people missed the fact that the IMF chief had her home raided by the French police just a few days before this happened, looking for evidence of corruption. Ostensibly, they found none, but no one is saying. As these threats of a sell-off began, the price of gold slid, and it slid dramatically. And it caused a massive gold rush all over the globe. Why? Well, because gold buys the same amount of property today as it did in 1850. Metal gold doesn't lose its value. Now, what happens when this gold, this physical gold, begins to move around is the people that have the paper title to that gold get kind of nervous. Meanwhile, word has been spreading among the wealthy financial families in both North America and Europe that they had better grab their physical gold out of the banks while the grabbing is good. This is creating, to say the least, havoc in the financial community. No, you don't really see people banging down the doors of the bank saying, "Where's my gold? I have these certificates. I want it." But there are all kinds of funny things happening. Last week, $650,000 worth of gold that came in from Ecuador arrived by air, went into the cargo hold, came out of the cargo hold, was picked up by the tug, went into a tunnel of the airport, and disappeared. You haven't heard anything else in the news about that. I don't even know if the gold was ever found. Lots of funny business going on. At least one major international bank has already declared that it will be settling those accounts in cash from now on, not gold. The paper gold scam is starting to unravel. How does it turn into a scam? I'm really glad you asked that question. Because gold positions can either be long or they can be short. Now, who in their right mind would short gold? Gold has been going up. Gold holds its value. Why would you short gold? It's a hedge. You short gold because of one of two things. You either know the price is going to go down, or you're printing the paper gold bullion out of nothing. You're just serializing it out of printing paper. And the major houses, Fidelity, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, they simply borrow their certificates and then sell them to people, and they keep the money. That's what makes it a scam. Now, for years, it has been widely known that the promises that banks have made regarding their gold far exceed their actual ability to deliver. But we have never reached a moment of this kind of crisis before. It's just been one of those kind of crisis pending things, sort of like balancing a lot of plates on the top of long fiberglass straws. As long as you keep the plates spinning, well, everything's fine. But if anybody ever walks away from those fiberglass rods, quits keeping the plates spinning, eventually the plates begin to fall and it makes a terrible crash. And that's exactly what we're seeing happening right now. Now, many of you probably have gold certificates in your retirement fund. You use it as a hedge, you know, against inflation. Now, I have a series of quotes from people that know precious metals, well, far better than I do, than most people. What these experts are saying is more than a little bit disturbing, significantly more. We saw all the gold products trade down significantly in the last couple of weeks, but one thing that did not trade down was gold coins, tangible, real gold. Now, why is that? Well, yeah, the price per ounce went down, but you go try to buy some. Yeah, the price of silver went down to $23 and some change. Go try to buy some. Go try to buy some physical silver. I guarantee you're going to pay $33, $34, even $35 an ounce. Why? Because the price of the physical metal did not trade down, only the bullion. Now that's going to show you people don't want the certificates. They don't want anything else. They want the real product. They want the real gold. They want the real silver. And we have been saying for a year on this program, that when you buy silver, don't buy the bullion. Yes, it's tradable. You can put it down at your local Merrill Lynch account or your local Fidelity account, your local Ed Jones. You can do that, of course, the bullion. But you can't do the physical metal. Why? Because they don't have a capacity to keep that. Metals like gold and silver, platinum, rhodium, palladium, they're storage metals. That is to say, once you buy them, either the silver coins, which are not entirely silver, of course, they have a little bit of copper blended in there for durability, or the silver bars, which come in sizes from about 1 gram for gold, 1 ounce for silver, all the way up to, well, you can get 100 ounces if you can afford it. To buy those, you have to find them available on the market, and they're not making any more silver. Okay, they're not smelting, they're not casting, they're not minting any more silver bars. Most of the bars that you're buying right now are 2012 bars or 1996 bars, and they're just traded around. If you find them, buy them. When you get the bar at your house, do not put it in your safety deposit box. Take it home. Put it in a box, put it in a safe, find a jar, put it under your bed, put it, you know, behind the bread in your bread box, and keep it because it's a storage metal. Now, let me tell you what some of the very wealthy are saying, and we try to follow what they do so that you can see what is really going on with the algorithm. How about billionaire Eric Sprott? Here's what he says. So we see all these paper trading volumes going through that, that bear absolutely no relationship to what's going on in the physical markets. As you know, I have always been a proponent of the fact that supply in the gold market was way less than demand, and by a very large factor. I think demand exceeds supply by at least 60%. The central banks are surreptitiously supplying that gold, and ultimately they will be running on fumes. When we hear about the LBMA not willing to deliver gold, and J.P. Morgan's inventories at the COMEX have gone from 2.4 million ounces down to 160,000 ounces, it just makes you realize that all of this paper trading means nothing. It's the real physical market that you have to rely on. Now, how about J.S. Kim, also one of the wealthiest people in the world? COMEX gold vaults were recently drained of 2 million ounces of physical gold in one quarter. That's 3 months, 90 days, 2 million ounces of physical gold left. It was the largest withdrawal of physical gold bullion from COMEX vaults in one quarter during the entire 12-year gold and silver bull market. There has been speculation about the reasons that spurred these massive withdrawals of gold from COMEX vaults, but the most reasonable speculation is that no one trusts the bankers to hold on to their physical gold anymore, especially in light of, and this is fact two that J.S. Kim brings up, that both registered and eligible stocks of gold had heavily declined in recent months. Why did they do that? Because J.P. Morgan Stanley was sitting on over 300,000 short contracts on gold. They were also, silver. Such an event signals a general distrust of the banking system from everyone holding gold in the registered COMEX vaults. Now, keep in mind that J.P. Morgan Stanley has the largest silver vault, the largest vault containing silver and gold of any bank in the United States. We don't know about Fort Knox. Somebody just texted me, what about Fort Knox? We don't know. There has not been a general accounting of Fort Knox since 1945. There's been a walkthrough, but no one has actually gone in, sampled the bars, make sure that they're 100% gold, and count them and weigh them and do an accounting. It's been a long, long time. One of the largest European banks, ABN AMRO, defaulted on their gold contracts and informed their clients that they would only settle their gold bullion contracts in cash and not in physical gold. Well, cash is nice today, but cash does not allow you to hedge against the floating currency value. So what is apparent is that the level of trust in bankers to safekeep physical gold and physical silver is disappearing, and as it should be, and as it should already have been for years now. But marketing and, you know, advertising and the fact that lots of bank buildings have been built, and they sort of build them like churches, and when you walk in, it's like the tellers go, shh, there's money here. Be careful as you pass that vault, okay? Be reverent. But truth always takes some time to catch up to reality. The bankers spread lies, and that is what is happening now. All those lies are unraveling. Why did they do that? Well, they do it because of programs like X Squared Radio. And they do it because of other investigative reporters that are not being paid money by the banksters. I have been warning people never trust the bankers in deals involving gold and silver. Been saying that since I started this program, and even more in the last year. Silver fraud whistleblowers and London trader, for instance, Andrew Maguire. He stated that the LBMA was having trouble settling gold contracts and bullion as well, and stated that institutions that asked for physical settlement were told they would be cash settled instead by a bullion bank. In plain English, this is a default. It's a default. There's no other way to put it, Earth Explorers. The banks stole the money. So Andrew McGuire reported that the LBMA had already gone into default. In light of Fact 1 and Fact 2 from J.S. Kim, the dominoes were starting to tumble, and the house of cards that the banksters had built in gold and silver paper derivatives to deceive and hide the true fundamentals of the physical gold and physical markets from the entire world was rapidly beginning to rot. A financial earthquake of magnitude, 4.5? Was quickly threatening to evolve into one of the biggest financial earthquakes of all time, in which the world's confidence in all global fiat currencies would effectively have a well-deserved funeral. It is like I have said in this program before, it is as though 10 of the wealthiest people in the world sat down to play cards one day. They all came with a pile of gold and silver, and they sat down at the table, and they played cards, and they bet, and they anteed, and they lost, and they bet, and anteed, and won. And before too long, nobody at the table could ante up. Everybody looked up from their green visors and said, "Hey, wait a minute. There should be one big-ass pile of chips at this table somewhere." But there wasn't. It was all gone. Everyone, all 10 card players, did not have any money. And now they're looking around at the dealer, which is the bank. The banks, the banksters, they stole it all. One more authority, Jim Sinclair, also a wealthy authority. He says, "I think the reality is the supply situation is extremely volatile at this point. And even discussing it is like rubbing a raw nerve to the people who are in charge. Those people in charge want one more bonus check, one more annual 7-digit bonus check, and they're out of there. They take their Jaguars and their Lamborghinis and their Ferraris and their 5 homes and their G5s, and they're out of there. And they leave who? You, holding the paper." The amount of discussion on the subject of warehouse supply that is represented by the gold leases, that's where traders borrow the gold with which to trade, indicated to the central planners that the demand for physical was going to continue to affect the exchanges. Although they did not expect any grandstand delivery, the mere continued draining of physical inventories was threatening the very functioning of the paper exchange. Why? Wow, ostensibly, you could trade paper forever as long as people believe in it. You can trade dollars forever as long as people believe in the talismans that are printed on the front and the back, as long as you believe those words, "In God We Trust," or "E Pluribus Unum," or "The Faith and Credit of the United States of America," you could trade it all you want and people will have faith in it. That threatening of the paper exchange and its ability to continue functioning is really taking off the blinders and revealing the truth behind the critical question. Where is the gold? Where's the gold? I don't have it. You don't have it. 10 guys sitting at the table once trading gold, playing cards, they don't have it. The question now is, where has the gold gone? Who has all this gold? Because of the nature of gold leasing, all of this gold has been purchased and repurchased and overpurchased, and it has gone somewhere. The reality of the empty vaults cannot be denied. It reveals that the gold has gone missing. We're seeing this rush to physical gold, not only in the retail markets, but also for the institutional players and also the individual players. Not that you and I are big players. We can afford to buy an ounce or two at a time, maybe. Maybe more ounces of silver than gold, for sure. But it's just overwhelming. It's about 130-to-1 ratio. That's the ratio of paper to physical gold. I mean, seriously, call up your Fidelity broker. Call up your Merrill Lynch broker. Go down and sit at your local Edward Jones office. That's a regional broker that exists almost coast to coast now. Hilliard and Lyons. Go in and sit down and talk to them and ask them if you can trade physical gold. They'll tell you no. But can you trade the gold bullion and silver bullion? Of course you can. They'll take it. It's a tradable security. It's a derivative. But it's collapsing. I'm telling you, and I have been telling you for a year, it is collapsing. If you can go to eBay and buy an ounce today, buy an ounce today. We've had listeners to this program who have written me and are on the verge of retiring or have retired and had a substantial amount of cash and CDs and things like that in their bank. And I said, listen, if you have a 401k or you have a large amount of cash in the bank, get it out and put it in physical metal. Put it in real estate. Put it in something that they can't take away, that's not going to canker or rust or change. Yes, the cash value of real estate floats up and down. Of course it does. But the actual value of real estate, it doesn't change. Land, houses, buildings, ports, utilities, they don't change in value. It's only the cash that changes. They're still valuable. But paper is nothing. Now, how about Gerhard Schubert? He's the head of the precious metals at Emirates NBD, also a great authority. He says, I have not seen in my 35 years in precious metals such a determined and strong global physical demand for gold. The UAE, that's United Arab Emirates, physical markets have been cleared out by buyers from all walks of life. That's you and me. That's Main Street people. Go to Dubai and find out for yourself. Go to Abu Dhabi yourself. Find out for yourself. Go to Mumbai. Go to London. Go to New York. Go to Houston. Go to LA. Anywhere you want and try to buy physical gold in any quantity, physical silver. You're going to have a tough time. The premiums which have been asked for, and by that I mean the amount over spot. Let's say silver is $23 and you can buy it for $1.49 over spot. That's what they'll tell you. Can you find it? No. You're going to be paying $10 over spot, 30% over spot. Okay? They have been paid by the cornerstone of the gold price recovery. It is very rare that physical markets can have a serious impact on market prices, which are normally driven solely by derivatives and the futures contracts. That is to say, gold's going to go up, gold's going to go down, the quantity of gold here, the quantity of silver there, blah, blah, blah. Normally, that's what it's driven by. Well, it isn't now. It's being driven by the actual physical quantities. And sooner or later, zombie America is going to go busting in that bank, and they're going to rip that vault door off the hinges, and they're going to gasp because what they thought was a $1 trillion bank is actually nothing but a vault door with a bunch of promises behind it. Now, Gerhard goes on to say, I did speak during the week with several refineries in the world, of course, including the UAE refineries. And the waiting period for 995 kilo bars is easily 2 to 3 weeks and goes into June in some cases, probably July. And a large portion of the 995 kilo bars in the UAE goes normally into the Indian market. But a lot of the available 995 kilo bars are destined for Turkey at this time. We heard that premiums paid in Turkey have reached anything between $20 and $35 per ounce. That, my friends, when it comes to precious metals, is highway robbery. Why? Because it doesn't go into the price of the gold. It goes into the pocket of the broker. Why? Because it's rare. It's valuable. And they don't have any. Excuse me while I take a sip of ice water. I'm making a very serious case here because I don't want to let it go this hour. I want you to understand thoroughly. I want you to replay this hour for yourself, for your banker friend, or for your parents or your broker. And I want you to be perfectly clear that the collapse has already occurred. Now let's talk. Listen to James Turk. He says, another indication of the demand for large bars is the huge drawdown in the gold stock in COMEX warehouses. It is noteworthy that COMEX reports show the drawdown is largely the result of dealers removing their inventory, their working stock. And when that happens, you know the availability of supply is constrained because normally they don't touch these vaults. They trade in what trades in and out. They don't go into the bank. They don't go into the vault. When you go to play cards at the casino, you arrive. You have not been partaking of adult beverages. What you do is you start with the money that you came to gamble with. You bet a few rounds, and you make some money, and you make back what you walked into the casino with, correct? And then you take those chips or that cash and you take it to your room and you leave it there because that's what you came with. Now you're a little more loose. You know, you've had a little bit more whiskey and water or whatever it is that you are enjoying yourself with while you're playing, because that's what it is. It's a game. And you gamble away. And if you make a lot of money, you can not only pay for your trip, but pick up a Ferrari and a diamond ring on your way out. Yes, you can buy them at Atlantic City and Reno and also in Las Vegas. Or you walk away from the table penniless. But it's okay because you have the money you came with in the room. But these guys have gone to the room several times. And they've ripped the mattress off the bed looking for any money that might be left behind. They've turned the couch upside down. They've opened every crevice. They've vacuumed the carpet down near the baseboard. They found every coin they can find. And still, they owe the dealer money. What all of this means, James says, is one thing. If the central planners want to keep the precious metals at these low prices to meet the demand for physical metal, they will need to empty more metal from the central bank vaults or borrow metal from the ETFs, as some have suggested is happening already. That's the hotel room I was telling you about. Otherwise, the central planners will have to step back, stop their intervention, thereby letting the price of gold and silver rise so that demand tapers off, bringing demand and the supply of physical metal back toward some kind of balance. Now, we've seen this same situation several times over the last 12 years, he says. It is what I have been calling a managed retreat. Despite the current weakness, I firmly believe we have again entered a critical period where the central planners will need to retreat once again in order to let the gold and silver prices climb higher. In other words, leave the casino. In other words, the price of gold sitting somewhere around $1,400 and some change, the price of silver sitting around $24, I think it rose $1.50 this week, $24.50 an ounce. It's ridiculous. It is what we have been calling on this program the silver accident. This is where the short traders are really going to get burned. Those hundreds of thousands of gamblers that said the price of gold and silver was going to continue to drop are going to get burned. Why? Because gold and silver are going to go up. How do they get burned? Aha, I'm glad you asked that question. Because they don't own the silver and gold. They only own the paper. They only own the option. They own the derivative. And when the price goes back up, the exchange says you have to pay up. You've got to buy the gold to make your contract good. But guess what? The gold doesn't exist. Not at that price. So they got to start buying the gold to make their call. And we're not talking about billions here. We're talking about trillions of dollars. J.P. Morgan Stanley sits right now with about $2.3 trillion of cash on deposits. That's your money. That's my money. That's your local bank's deposit on that bank. What does that mean? Well, that means they have to start dipping into that cash in order to make those contracts good. Or they're going to go out of business. They're going to go bankrupt. And when we're talking about too big to fail, this is bigger than any country can bail out. We could bail out a few hundred billion, maybe even 500 billion, but we can't bail out trillions. $5 to $20 trillion is what these short traders are going to get burned. Now, it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of guys, but the problem is that they're the bank. They're the ones that your bank buys the money from to loan to you to get your home. They're the banks that back up the bonds that the cities create in order to build roads and bridges and new racetracks and central parks and update, you know, different things like ports and railroads and things like that. That's where that money comes from. And if that happens, then what is now AA rated United States of America is going to become a junk bond. Now let's listen to what the Golden Truth says. He says, and then I get a call from a close friend in New York City last Friday. That's a week ago, a couple days ago. His career has been in private wealth management in the private bank department of the too big to fail banks. He's been looking for work and chats with old colleagues all the time. He called me Friday and told me he just got off the phone with a very high-level private banker from a big euro-based TBTF bullion bank, but who was at JP Morgan until about 6 months ago. Well, guess what? He escaped with a little bit of information. This guy told my friend that there is a scramble by many very wealthy European families, entities, and people. This is not one generation money. When we're talking very wealthy, we're talking 10 to 15 generations of money. We're talking Rothschild generations. We're talking about the Queen of the Netherlands generations. Very wealthy European families and entities. To get their 400-ounce bars out of the big bank vaults. We also found that Germany has recalled its gold. He knows this personally, for a fact. He said the private banker community is small over there, and the big wealthy families all talk to each other and act on the same rumors and sentiment. The Bundesbank Fed and the ABN AMRO situations triggered this move. He knows for a fact J.P. Morgan tried to calm fears about 3 months ago, about the time we started reporting on it very heavily at the beginning of the year here on X Squared Radio, by sending a letter to its very wealthy clients assuring them their bars were safe. Everything is under control in allocated accounts. He said right now those same families are walking into the big banks like J.P. Morgan and demanding delivery of their bars or threatening to take their hundreds of millions in investment portfolios to competitors. His wording was, these people are putting a gun to the heads of private banks and demanding their gold. I can tell you right now, Earth Explorers, that when it comes to gold, people get a little crazy. I've known a lot of gold miners. Maybe you have too. They get a little crazy about where their claims are, what's in the ground, what they've mined, how many ounces they have here or there. They sell off the big chunks for several dollars over spot, maybe double, because the demand is so high. But you reach in there and try to scrape a few of those chips off the table for yourself, and you're going to draw back a stump. I know this information is good because I know my friend's background, and when he tells me his source is plugged in, the guy is plugged in. Not only that, my friend's source said that there's no doubt that someone like John Paulson, who we've talked about on this program before, does not necessarily specifically him, but entities like him, or it may include him, have held a gun to SPDR Gold Trust ETF, that's NY Circa on the exchange, and demanded delivery of physical in exchange for their shares. Regarding the Bundesbank Fed situation, recall that the Bundesbank asked to have some portion of its gold sitting, supposedly, in the New York Fed vault in New York City, sent back to Germany. We talked about that. It's about 1,800 tons. That's a lot of gold. They're also taking their gold back from the south. Keep in mind, it's probably got to travel by train or by armored car or even by plane in small amounts. You don't want to put all that gold in one place. It'll happen just like the $650,000 in gold that disappeared at the airport this week. After behind-the-scenes negotiations, the Fed agreed to ship 300 tons back over 7 years. Oh, you can't have it today. No. We're cleaning the room right now. We've lost the key to the vault. We know the gold's in there. But it's going to take us 7 years to get your 300 tons back. How confident do you think Germany is right now? To this day, the time required for that shipment has never been explained. Not once. Believe me, you don't want to negotiate with Germans. They don't do that very well. You know, I talk to Germany every single week on the phone, and they're very matter-of-fact people, and they always hold up their word, and they always deliver. In fact, usually they over-deliver on their engineering and anything else I've asked them to do. But when you start him-hawing, when you start saying, I'll deliver that next week or in a month, they get very firm. Now, Venezuela also demanded the return of its 200 tons held in London, New York City, and Switzerland. And they received it all within about 4 months. You remember that, don't you? The price of gold shot up like $500 an ounce when Venezuela did that. It greatly upset the market. But they only had to wait 4 months. Germany, you're going to have to wait 7 years. And regarding the ABN AMRO situation, ABN AMRO offered a gold investment account product that offered physical delivery of the gold in the investment account when the investor cashes out. That's what they offered. About a week before the gold price smash, ABN sent a letter to its clients informing that the physical delivery of the bullion was no longer available and that all accounts would be settled with cash at redemption. By the way, that cash is changing value by the minute. By the minute. Why? Because the Fed is printing about $80 billion a month. That's what they're pumping the market with. That's what they're pumping the market with right now. And it is not going over well out there. It is not going over well at all. So the situation is getting rough. The situation is getting interesting. So what does this all mean? It means that we're entering a period when there will be unprecedented volatility for precious metals. There will be tremendous ups and downs as this crisis plays out, and I don't think there will be many downs as far as the price of the metal, maybe the availability of the metal. Because the bankers are trying to keep the paper gold scam from completely unraveling. Meanwhile, nations such as China continue to stockpile gold as if the end of the world was coming. According to Zero Hedge, Chinese gold imports set a brand new all-time record in March, just a couple of months ago. Quite the contrary, as export data released by the Hong Kong Census and Statistics Department overnight showed, gold imports for China in March exploded to an all-time high of 223.5 tons. And the number for April is expected to be even higher. We don't know the number yet, but we will soon. Now, does China know something that the rest of us do not? Well, I reckon they do, since they're the ones with the money. They're the ones that are holding the debt of the United States of America. They're the ones that have bought the paper. They're the ones that sold off almost all their short-term securities that they bought from America, debt at, I might add, a great financial hit for them. So why did they do that? Well, we told you on this program, the reason they did it was because the United States sold weapons to Taiwan. China was mad. They couldn't do anything about it on a out in the press front. So what did they do? They sold off all the short-term debt. Yeah, they bypassed all the interest on that stuff, but they sold it at a discount. 60 days later, Standard & Poor's downgrades the United States. Why? Well, it's not because our debt to GDP is so high. That's not really scary. The reason is there's nothing backing it. Now, we are also seeing a rapid decoupling between spot prices and physical prices. I've seen that myself. I bought silver 2 weeks ago. Could I get it for $23.50 an ounce? No way. I paid $31 an ounce for it. I had friends in California that tried to buy silver bullion. It went up a buck and a half in one day. In fact, it is quickly getting to the point where the spot price of gold and the spot price of silver are becoming irrelevant. Exactly what I said in January. If you weren't buying silver as the price was slowly going down over the last 3 months, you missed out. It's not too late because we're not going to see $400 silver for a while, but it's going to pop. For example, the demand for silver coins has become so intense, some dealers are charging premiums 30, 40, 50% over spot prices for silver eagles. By the way, silver eagles are only 39.9%. They're about 4.5% copper. So they're not quite 93% silver. If you want pure silver, don't buy the eagles. You got to buy the bars. Now, the bars for silver come in half ounce, 1 ounce, 5 ounce, 10 ounce. You can get 50s and 100s, and you can even get 10-pound bars of silver. Some of it's not so pretty, but it is 99.99% pure. That would have been regarded as insane a few years ago. Nobody would have seen that. Brokers are ripping people off. But people are now willing to pay these kinds of premiums because they're recognizing the importance of actually having physical gold and silver in their possession. And they're willing to pay a significant premium in order to get it. And when gold slipped $500 an ounce, the average investor saw an opportunity and they tried to capitalize on it. And they can't because they can't find the gold. We are moving into uncharted territory, Earth Explorers. That's what we're doing. We're exploring uncharted territory. The paper gold scam is rapidly coming to an end. In the long term, we will greatly benefit. This will greatly benefit those that are holding significant amounts of physical gold. That could be you. And silver, by the way. Silver is actually affordable for the average guy. All right, we've run a little bit long. Let me go ahead and take a quick break. We'll be right back in about 5 minutes. Let me drink some water, check in on the race for you, and find out how this marathon Coca-Cola 600 is going. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement. basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brookside New, coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Number 20, Kenseth, is now in the lead at the Coca-Cola 600, about 2 miles from here. I can hear it outside my window. So if you hear that drone over the microphone, that is the sound of 35,000 horsepower of cars going around the track at breakneck speeds at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. Oops, I gave away my location. Well, not exactly. Charlotte's a big city. X Squared Radio has been on BBS Radio now for 8 years, and from time to time we kind of change up the format a little bit. Tonight it is all me. Tomorrow. Next week on X Squared Radio, we have an incredible treat for you, and that is Diana West. She's the author of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. It's published on St. Martin's Press. It is almost available on Amazon. It is probably going to be live this week. She's also the author of The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Her weekly newspaper column is syndicated by Universal UCLIC, and West also serves as Washington correspondent for the European weekly newspaper Dispatch International. West is one of 19 co-authors, including Frank Gaffney, Andrew C. McCarthy, and James Woosley, of Sharia, The Threat to America. That's a 2010 publication. She will be headlined on bbsradio.com this week. Don't miss this interview. We're trying to work it out right now with her for either a pre-recorded or hopefully a live appearance next Sunday. Those of you that have seen her interviews know that not only is she a gifted author, but she's a fantastic researcher, and she's very passionate about her work. And what you're going to find out in this book is nothing short of stunning, absolutely stunning. We have I did a lot of research in my book, Alienated Nation, which came out last June, almost a year ago. About Roosevelt and the establishment of the agency government, which you now know as the shadow government. It was established in 1933, a series of agencies that were created apparently out of whole cloth overnight, complete with budgets and charters and very, very detailed missions about their agencies. And what happened was a clause in the Constitution which allows the president to have a cabinet. Now, cabinet originally was loosely put into the Constitution as a group of experts because, come on, presidents are elected because they look good on TV now. In those days, they had to be well known nationally because you just couldn't do marketing to every little hamlet in the nation. And consequently, they weren't experts at everything. So they were allowed to have experts in various fields that advised them. Like, this is what a paved road is, Mr. President. This is what a bridge is. This is what space exploration is. Those kinds of things. And as these various agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus grew, their budgets grew. And it became unwieldy in a very short amount of time. Well, here we are, 81 years later, and the agencies have become the government. The cabinet has become a group of secretaries. The secretaries are appointed by the president. Yes, they're approved by the Senate, advice and consent, you know, unless, of course, you get to this president who can just appoint whoever he wants without advice and consent by the Senate, even though the Senate is in session. Does anybody do anything about it? No, everything's fine. As these agencies have grown, they have now accumulated the ability to tax. They have accumulated the ability to assign fees and fines. They have they can take police actions. They can seize your property, your bank accounts. We have seen that with just last week. We saw the Bitcoin completely seized by one of these agencies, the Department of Homeland Security. They just took all the money from Mt. Gox. It is, I've got a little recording tonight. I'll play you about it, but it's absolutely stunning. It's just unbelievable. The sweep and the power and the authority that they have. They've taken over the healthcare system. They've taken over just about everything. This was all started by Roosevelt, and it was inherited by Eisenhower, and then on to our modern presidency. Eisenhower was really the first president that began to make use of television, but it was, you know, Kennedy, Nixon, on and on, that really began to make use of TV to sell their ideas to the American people and to get the people behind their what I call professional voter class. The professional voter class arrived quite naturally, as it would in any democracy. In any democracy, you realize that when the general public can vote for themselves a piece of the treasury, they will most immediately do it. The politician that figures out how to sell the treasury to the voters can never be removed from office. That's where we are right now. So what happened was unspeakable, to be sure. But what Diana West has uncovered in her book, American Betrayal, will absolutely blow you away. I feel it most appropriate to let you know on this Memorial Day weekend that President Roosevelt and President Eisenhower ordered that 15,000 American troops, not 1,500, 15,000 American troops would not be delivered from prisoner of war camps in the Soviet Union after World War II. Did you ever hear that? No. But it came right from the top, and the cover-up began in the White House, both White Houses. 15,000 of America's greatest generation were allowed to grow old and die in prison camps. Now, why would a president pass up the biggest ticker tape parade in world history and allow those prisoners of war to stay in those prison camps in a country we were not even at war with? You're going to find out next week right here on X Squared Radio, exclusively right here. All right, let's find out what's going on. A statement was made this week. We can't afford to irritate the Saudis by actually looking into who backed 9/11, especially with oil prices going up now. Yeah. Now, We haven't talked a lot about 9/11 on this program. We don't do conspiracy theories as a matter of fact. We will look into things that have merit, but we're not going to go down the rabbit hole. Too many people have, and they're still there. But one of the things that has come out in the investigations is that the Saudis financed a lot of the terror, and they still do. There are two kinds of terrorists, and my colleague Glenn Beck says this better than I do, and I will give him credit where credit is due. And that is that there are really two kinds of terrorists. There are the dirt terrorists, the ones that actually do the dirty work, that actually blow things up and are blown up. And then there are the brain terrorists, the ones that pay for things, that arrange for things, that falsify identifications, that bribe government officials, that make deals one way or the other, either to let prisoners of war stay in a camp, to let ambassadors die, or to let bombers sneak right in front of hundreds of federal agents and detonate two bombs on live television. A Saudi family who fled their Sarasota area home weeks before 9/11 had many connections to individuals associated with the terrorist attacks on 9/11. One partially declassified document marked secret lists three of those individuals and ties them to Venice, Florida, flight school, where suicide hijackers Mohammed Atta, Marwan al-Shahi, trained. Accomplice Ziad Jarrah took flying lessons at another school about a block away. Atta and al-Shahi were at the controls of the jetliners that slammed into the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center, killing nearly 3,000 people. And by the way, ending my business on the same day. Yes, I was doing business with Aon Insurance Company, which died in that attack. I had enough money in the bank to pay payroll for another month, including the insurance for all of my employees, while I found them other jobs at other places so that they would be taken care of. I took myself immediately off salary and took care of my employees. That business was done. Jarrah was the hijacker pilot of United Airlines 93, which was either blown to pieces above rural Pennsylvania or it crashed. We'll never know the truth there. The names, addresses, and dates of birth of the three individuals tied to the flight school were blanked out before the records were released to BrowardBulldog.org and ongoing Freedom of Information Act litigation individuals. The information in the documents runs counter to previous FBI statements, which means the FBI lied in writing. It also adds to concerns raised by official investigations but never explored, that the full truth about Saudi Arabia and the 9/11 attacks has yet to be told. The documents are the first released by the FBI about its once secret probe in Sarasota, Florida. Information contained in the documents flatly contradicts prior statements by FBI agents under oath in Miami and Tampa who have said the investigation found no evidence connecting the al-Hijis to the hijackers or the 9/11 plot. Concerned residents in the gated community of Prestancia tipped the FBI shortly after the 9/11 attacks to the al-Hijis' sudden departure in late August 2001. The family left behind three cars, clothes, furniture, diapers, toys, food, and other items. In other words, they hightailed it out of town. A counterterrorism officer and Prestancia's former administrator, Larry Berberick, both said an analysis of gatehouse security records, logbooks, and snapshots of license tags had determined that vehicles either driven by or carrying several of the future hijackers had visited the al-Hiji home. Phone records revealed similar, though indirect, ties to the hijackers, said the counterterrorism officer, who spoke on condition of anonymity, of course. Now, the Daily Beast also a reputable investigative publication, reported last year, the FBI-led investigation in Sarasota reportedly focused on Saudi millionaire Abdulaziz Al-Hijji and his wife, Anoud. Their upscale home was owned by Anoud's Al-Hijji father, Essam Ghazawi, an advisor to Prince Fahd bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Al-Saud, the nephew of King Fahd. An FBI informant hosted and rented a room to two hijackers in 2000. Specifically, investigators for the Congressional Joint Inquiry discovered that an FBI informant had hosted and even rented a room to two hijackers, and that when the inquiry sought to interview the informant, the FBI refused outright and then hid him in an unknown location, and that a high-level FBI official stated these blocking maneuvers were undertaken under orders from the White House. As the New York Times notes, Senator Bob Graham, the Florida Democrat, who is a former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, accused the White House on Tuesday of covering up evidence. The accusation stems from the Federal Bureau of Investigation's refusal to allow investigators for a congressional inquiry and the independent September 11th commission to interview an informant. His name was Abdusattar Saik, who had been the landlord in San Diego of two of the September 11th hijackers. The two hijackers were Saudis. Indeed, 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudis. The Daily Beast also reported last year, in San Diego, allegations of links between Saudi government and the 9/11 hijackers revolve around two enigmatic Saudi men, Omar al-Bayoumi and Osama Baznan, both of whom have long since left the United States. Al-Bayoumi had previously worked for the Saudi government in civil aviation, a part of the Saudi Defense Department, and was alleged by many Saudi San Diego Muslims to be an agent for the Saudi government who reported on the activities of Saudi-born students living in Southern California. As you know, Saudi students... Excuse me while I take a sip of my ice water. Many Saudi students come to this country, some of them for academics. Most of them come to go to college. Some of them come to enroll at the college and never attend the college. And they are given a stipend. They always drive the best cars, you know, their parties are the best, blah, blah, blah. I was in college once, I know this. And if their activities get a little bit too shaky or they step out of bounds too much, then these investigators, Saudi investigators, pick them up and send them home. In early 2000, Al-Bayoumi invited two of the hijackers, Khalid Alimdar and Nawaf Al-Hazmi, to San Diego from Los Angeles. He told authorities he met the two men by chance when he sat next to them at a restaurant. Yeah. As Newsweek reported in 2002, Al-Bayoumi's invitation was extended on the same day that he visited the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles for a private meeting. Sound a little shady to you? It does to me, too. Al-Bayoumi arranged for the two future hijackers to live in an apartment near San Diego Islamic Center Mosque and paid $1,500 to cover their first two months of rent. When asked not long after the 9/11 attacks about Al-Bayoumi's possible involvement, San Diego County Sheriff Bill Gore, then the San Diego head of the FBI, told this reporter that there was no evidence that Al-Bayoumi played a role. Also, a lie. But a former top FBI official later told Newsweek, "We firmly believe that Al-Bayoumi had knowledge of the 9/11 plot." After 9/11, Al-Bayoumi was detained by New Scotland Yard while living in the UK. Gore said the FBI agent sent agents to London to interview him, but he was released a week later and allowed to return to Saudi Arabia. Go figure. Newsweek reported that classified sections of the Congressional 9/11 inquiry indicated that the Saudi embassy in London pushed for al-Bayoumi's release. Now, where is he now? Where is al-Bayoumi now? I can't say too much, but what I can tell you is that he is alive and living in Saudi Arabia, says Graham. Now, how would he know? How would the senator know? As for Bazan, whom Graham calls Bayoumi's successor, Newsweek reported that he received monthly checks for several years, totaling as much as $73,000 from the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar, and his wife, Princess Haifa Faisal. The checks were sent because Bazan's wife, Majeda Dwikat, needed thyroid surgery, Newsweek and other media outlets reported. But Dwikat inexplicably signed many of the checks over to al-Bayoumi's wife, Manal Bajadra. This money allegedly made its way into the hands of hijackers, al-Midar and al-Azmi, according to the congressional report. At a post-9/11 gathering in San Diego, Bazan allegedly called the attack a wonderful, glorious day and celebrated the hijackers' heroism, a law enforcement official told Newsweek. Despite all this, he was ultimately allowed to return to Saudi Arabia. Another man who might have helped investigators to get to the bottom of this mystery is Abdu Sattar Shaikh, a longtime FBI asset, in other words, a snitch, in San Diego, who was friends with al-Bayoumi and invited two of the San Diego-based hijackers to live in his home for a while. However, Shaikh was not allowed by the FBI or the Bush administration to testify before the 9/11 Commission or the J1CI. Now, why or JICI? Why is that? Well, because he was an FBI snitch. He knew the inside. He had some dirt. For me, that was the low point of the investigation, says Graham. Bayoumi introduced the hijackers to Shaikh, who clearly knew a lot, but the FBI, who had Shaikh in protective custody, seemed to care more about protecting their asset than allowing us to find out what he knew about 9/11. The report goes on and on and on, and what we find out is that the administration announced after the The investigation into the Saudi government's alleged connections to the hijackers seems to end right there. Arguably, the greatest crime mystery of our time has become a cold case. But it wakes up again. It wakes up again. Because a lot of things don't seem to make sense here. As we end 9/11 and we think, oh, well, goodness, we got Bush out of office. We got the Bushes out of office and all that's going to end. The CIA director, Herbert Walker Bush, and his son, George W. Bush, are now out of office. And, boy, we're glad we got all that corruption out of the White House. That's what people are saying. Well, it doesn't end there. It continues there because this administration, the new one, the one that's in there now, announced after the Benghazi attack that a protest by Muslims had turned violent. That was the party line. The administration also stated that there was nothing which could have been done to save the people killed within the consulate. Those are the two main statements. Now, you got to agree with me with that. By the way, if you have a disagreement or you have any opinion whatsoever on this, you're completely welcome and open to give it here on this program. Remember, the title of this program is X Squared Radio. It is a mathematical function. Any number that you put into X squared will come out positive. So you can rest assured. If you want to come on here and call yourself Mr. or Ms. X, that's fine. The number here is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. We have been saying that a lot of things did not make sense with this. Benghazi thing. First of all, let's just talk about the top three things. Let's just make them very clear. We know fact one, that mercenaries were coming into Libya for about 6 weeks prior to the attack. Locals knew it, the CIA knew it, and the soldiers that briefly and occasionally guarded the compound in Libya, in Benghazi, knew it. They knew something was up. They knew that these were trained. They were trained mercenaries. They were armed, and they were in town to cause up to no good. Now, fact number two, we know that the compound was largely unarmed. We know that the individuals that were there, that were obviously really, really good at hand-to-hand combat, did not really have weapons to guard a consulate with nothing more than a decorative wall around the outside. Fact number three, we know that there were assets within 2 hours of Benghazi that could have got there. They could have done a flyover. They could have parachuted in. They could have arrived in time to make a difference. Now, for anyone to say on the news that there was nothing that could have been done to save the people killed within the consulate because there was not enough time, we have to ask the question, how did they know there would not be enough time? How did they know that the attack was going to come again and that they were going to go in and wipe out everybody? How did they know that there was not enough time? They either didn't know and they were just talking out of their you-know-whats, or they did know. And that's what they need to get to the bottom of. Now, the number two American official in Libya, Deputy Chief of Mission in Libya, Gregory Hicks, you heard his testimony, as did I, who became the Chief of Mission after Ambassador Christopher Stevens was murdered, says everyone who worked at Benghazi consulate thought it was a terrorist attack from the get-go. There was no protest. There was no anger over a video. This was concocted by the administration. Similarly, Democratic Congressman Stephen Lynch agrees that the U.S. talking points after the Benghazi attack were a lie, an absolute fabricated lie. Now, Congressman Daryl Issa, that's the guy that you see heading up the committee, the guy that's trying to play both sides, he's trying to be Mr. Nonpartisan, notes that the U.S. ignored requests for more security, and this is prior to the attack. Guys, we need some more bombs. We need something up on the walls. We need dogs. We need something here to prevent me from just walking up the front walk here and bashing in the door. And theorize that the motive was to underplay the danger from terrorism. I think that the motives go beyond that. That's what I'd like to explore here. Because we know the Saudis were involved in 9/11. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt. Their money was there. They facilitated it by providing housing, by providing flight training, by providing mission orientation, by providing visas and travel. We know that they were involved. We also know that Ambassador Stevens met with a diplomat from Turkey just hours before this attack took place. That meeting was planned. We don't know the subject of that discussion, but we know what was on the table. What was on the table was 10 to 20,000 advanced missiles and rockets and bombs and chemicals that were now up for grabs in Libya since Muammar Gaddafi had been assassinated and rebels pretty much in charge of everything. More disturbing are tales of the lack of assistance from the United States. As CBS News reported, throughout the night, sources say Americans on the ground in Libya at times felt helpless and abandoned. A little like 15,000 POWs in Soviet Russia after World War II felt alone, helpless, abandoned. under orders of the president. We relied on Washington for dispassionate assessment, one eyewitness told CBS News. Instead, Washington officials were asking us what help we needed. We answered, send reinforcements, exclamation point. But they were told immediate help was not available. Embassy personnel say they repeatedly asked the defense attaché on site in Tripoli for military assistance. The plane left. The C-130 left. But the troops were asked to get off the plane. They were asked not to go. They stood around on the tarmac as that plane took off into the night, kicking dust, itching to go help their fellow Americans an hour and a half away that needed their help. They could not believe they were not being allowed to go in and defend American territory. One embassy official said, is there anything available? But the answer was no. What about Aviano? The official pressed, referencing the NATO airbase with U.S. assets in northeastern Italy. No, was the answer. Two of the four Americans killed that night died hours after the first attack began. Counterterrorism sources and internal emails reviewed by CBS News expressed frustration that key responders were ready to deploy. They were ready to go, but they were not called upon to help in the attack. National Security Council spokesman Tommy Vitor told CBS News the CSG was not needed. Counterterrorism group. But most devastating of all is Hicks' testimony that the U.S. prevented rescuers from reaching Benghazi. The deputy of slain U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens has told congressional investigators that a team of special forces was prepared in full armor to fly from Tripoli to Benghazi, and they were told to stand down. Hicks told investigators that SOC Africa, that's the South African command, Lieutenant Colonel Gibson and his team were on their way to board the C-130 from Tripoli to Benghazi prior to the attack on a second U.S. compound. When Colonel Gibson got a phone call from SOC Africa, which said, you can't go now. You don't have the authority to go now. So they missed the flight. They were told not to board the flight. So they missed it. Hicks told congressional investigators that if the U.S. had quickly sent a military aircraft just over Benghazi, just fly it over, they might have saved American lives. But U.S. Souda Bay Naval Base is an hour's flight from Libya. Hicks said, I believe if we had been able to scramble a fighter or aircraft or two over Benghazi as quickly as possible after the attack commenced, I believe there would have not been a mortar attack on the annex in the morning, because I believe the Libyans would have split. They would have been scared to death that we would have gotten a laser on them and killed them, Hicks testified. Two Americans died in the morning mortar attack. Remember, they didn't attack with mortars to begin with. They were just small arms fire, and they couldn't get in. The mortar fire arrived and precision hits on that compound, killed guards on the roof, punched holes in the building, and began burning it from the inside. Now, the real story at Benghazi. Are you ready? Yeah, you can go ahead and undo your seatbelt, because I think you need to hear this truth. And you might need to just drop to the floor and cry for a little bit. The U.S.-supported opposition, which overthrew Libya's Gaddafi, was largely comprised of al-Qaeda terrorists. Fact. According to a 2007 report by West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, the Libyan city of Benghazi was one of al-Qaeda's main headquarters and bases for sending al-Qaeda fighters into Iraq prior to the overthrow of Gaddafi. The Hindustan Times reported in 2011 There is no question that Al-Qaeda's Libyan franchise, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, is a part of the opposition. Bruce Riddell, former CIA officer and a leading expert on terrorism, told Hindustan Times, "It has always been Gaddafi's biggest enemy and its stronghold in Benghazi." Al-Qaeda is now largely in control of Libya. Indeed, Al-Qaeda flags were flown over the Benghazi courthouse once Gaddafi was toppled. Incidentally, Gaddafi was on the verge of invading Benghazi in 2011, 4 years after the West Point report cited Benghazi as a hotbed of Al-Qaeda terrorists. You remember, Gaddafi did not like them because he was really harshing the Libyan, the Al-Qaeda was harshing the Libyan people. They were terrorists to them, too. Gaddafi claimed, "Rightly, it turns out that Benghazi was an Al-Qaeda stronghold and a main source of the Libyan rebellion, but NATO planes stopped him and protected Benghazi." You get that? NATO planes stopped Gaddafi from invading Benghazi to wipe out Al-Qaeda. They stopped him from doing it. Starting to make a little sense to you now? CNN, The Telegraph, The Washington Times, and many other mainstream sources confirmed that Al-Qaeda terrorists from Libya have since flooded into Syria to fight Assad regime. Mainstream sources, and by the way, they're flooding in there with Libyan missiles. You remember the Turkish diplomat I was telling you about? You remember the meeting I told you about with Ambassador Stevens and the Turkish diplomat? Do you remember me telling you that the deal that they made probably involved those arms? And now you might know a little bit. You're going to hear the rest. Mainstream sources also confirmed that the Syrian opposition is largely comprised of Al-Qaeda terrorists. The New York Times reported just last week that virtually all of the rebel fighters are Al-Qaeda terrorists. The U.S. has been arming the Syrian opposition since 2006. Let me repeat that. The U.S. has been arming the Syrian opposition since 2006. And I'll repeat the sentence before. Virtually all of the rebel fighters are Al-Qaeda terrorists. Let's put the two sentences together. The U.S. has been arming Al-Qaeda terrorists to invade and attack Syria since 2006. The post-Gaddafi Libyan government is also itself a top funder and arms supplier of the Syrian opposition. Not Gaddafi, post-Gaddafi. This brings us to the murder of Ambassador Stevens. Get ready. The Wall Street Journal, Telegraph, and other sources, and right here on X Squared Radio, confirm that the U.S. consulate in Benghazi was mainly being used for a secret CIA operation. They say that the State Department was the State Department presence in Benghazi provided diplomatic cover for the previously hidden CIA mission. Reuters notes that the CIA mission involved finding and repurchasing heavy weaponry looted from Libyan government arsenals. In other words, the weapons didn't come from the United States. They didn't have American flags on them. They weren't made in Virginia and Alabama and Texas. They were made, they were bought, and they were housed in Libya. These were some of the best weapons money could buy because Gaddafi had money. He bought them, he stockpiled them, and he was using them and was going to use them. But they didn't want Gaddafi taking over Benghazi. They didn't want the Al-Qaeda terrorists to lose access to these weapons. And so Ambassador Stevens and the diplomat from Turkey made arrangements. There's growing evidence that U.S. agents, particularly murdered Ambassador Chris Stevens, were at least aware of heavy weapons moving from Libya to Al-Qaeda jihadists who were attacking Syria from within. In March 2011, Stevens became the official U.S. liaison to the Al-Qaeda-linked Libyan opposition, working directly with Abdel Hakim Belhaji of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, a group that has now disbanded, with some fighters reportedly participating in the attack that took Stevens' life. In November of 2011, the Telegraph reported that Belhaj, acting as head of the Tripoli Military Council, met with Free Syrian Army leaders in Istanbul and on the border with Turkey in an effort by the new Libyan government to provide money and weapons to the growing insurgency in Syria. And last month, the Times of London reported that a Libyan ship, obviously not under Gaddafi command, but a Libyan ship carrying the largest consignment of weapons for Syria had in fact docked in Turkey. The shipment reportedly weighed 400 tons and included SA-7 surface-to-air anti-aircraft missiles and rocket-propelled grenades. Reuters reports that Syrian rebels have been using those exact same heavy weapons to shoot down Syrian helicopters and fighter jets. The ship's captain was a Libyan from Benghazi and the head of an organization called the Libyan National Council for Relief and Support, which was presumably established by the new government. That means that Ambassador Stevens had only one person, Belhaj, between himself and the Benghazi man who brought heavy weapons to Syria. Furthermore, we know that jihadists are the best fighters in the Syrian opposition, but where did they come from? Last week, the Telegraph reported that an FSA, that's the the Free Syrian Army commander, called them Libyans when he explained that the FSA doesn't want these extremist people here. But they weren't Libyans. They were Al-Qaeda. And if the new Libyan government was sending seasoned Islamic fighters and 400 tons of heavy weapons to Syria through a port in southern Turkey, that means that a deal was brokered by Stevens, primary Libyan contact during the Libyan Revolution. Then the governments of Turkey and the U.S. surely knew about it, namely the White House, namely the State Department. Furthermore, there was a CIA post in Benghazi located 1.2 miles from the U.S. consulate, used as a base for, among other things, collecting information on the proliferation of weaponry looted from Libyan government arsenals, including surface-to-air missiles, and that its security features were more advanced than those at rented villa where Stevens died. And we know that the CIA has been funneling weapons to the rebels in southern Turkey. The question is whether the CIA had been involved in handing out the heavy weapons from Libya. Is that a hard connection for you to make? Are those two dots too far apart for you? In other words, Ambassador Stevens may have been a key player in deploying Libyan terrorists and arms to the fight the Syrian government. We couldn't do it directly because Russia was supporting Syria. We couldn't do it directly because Iran is supporting Syria. But we could do it indirectly by brokering the stolen weapons from Libya through the American ambassador to Turkey to get them to Al-Qaeda inside of Syria. I'm sorry, folks. I'm shaking my head here. I thought Al-Qaeda was our enemy. I thought Al-Qaeda was the largest heroin dealer in the world. I thought Al-Qaeda was the group that our president says we're at war with, that we've disbanded them, that we've largely reduced their ability to function. Then why would we be facilitating, funding, covering up, and then murdering our own U.S. ambassador to cover the trail? if we're fighting them. Other sources also claim that the U.S. consulate in Benghazi was mainly being used as a CIA operation to ship fighters and arms to Syria. Many have speculated that if normal security measures weren't taken to protect the Benghazi consulate or to rescue Ambassador Stevens, it was because the CIA was trying to keep an extremely low profile to protect its cover of being a normal State Department operation. That's what really happened in Benghazi. Make no mistake about it. No matter what comes out in the hearings, no matter what they tell you, that's what happened. The facts bear it out. Now, let's see how far the military is involved in this. You know, I often talk about the folks down at Wars R Us. Sometimes I'm referring to the folks at the Pentagon, but most of the time I'm referring to the folks at the State Department. They're the ones that sit around and make up all these scenarios. They're the ones that have wars and wars to end wars and wars to cover up wars, all in brown paper envelopes, all numbered, all ready to go in case this or that or the other thing happens. It's a plan. Is the military involved? Only in the sense that they're under orders to carry out the operation. Is the military involved? Only in the respect that the White House orders them to stand down when things go south. When the very people that we have sent in to do the dirty work are betrayed and not simply shot. Ambassador Stevens was raped and beaten and burned and left to die. He eventually did die at the hospital. Were they going to try and kidnap him? There are rumors out there that they were going to try and do that. Maybe broker a deal and maybe save his life. But it didn't happen. And there were generals, and there were admirals, and there were colonels that were ready to go save those men and women's lives, and it wasn't allowed to happen. Now, if I could send a stench over this microphone, I want you to listen to this. There were survivors. Yes, there were survivors. Guess where they are? They're in the hospital. In the United States. Who's spoken to them? No one. Their identities have been changed in the hospital so that you can't find them. Oh, the Secretary of State has been there. He's spoken to them, but none of the investigators have. Those people know the real story. We'll see if they really get subpoenaed, if we really find out what they knew. Now let's see what happened. You know the CIA boss, David Petraeus, right? He suddenly resigned. And you know what that was all about, right? Little affair, blah, blah, blah. In fact, his mistress came on and said, look, you know, Petraeus is a great guy, but after all, he is married and I've ended the affair. And she came out publicly today. But Petraeus was scheduled to testify under oath the next week before powerhouse and Senate committees regarding the Benghazi consulate. Many speculate that it wasn't an affair, but the desire to avoid testifying on Benghazi while the affair was made public. That was the real reason for Petraeus' sudden resignation. He didn't want to testify. He couldn't lie about this. What's the big picture? How is it going to unfold? That's a really good question. A lot of people want to know. Probably only about 35% of the country even know what this is about. When you mention the word Benghazi to the man on the street, they go, who? Who's Benghazi? What did he do? They don't know. That's why I'm talking about it right here on X Squared Radio. Whatever the scope of the CIA's operation in Benghazi, and whatever the real reason for the resignation of the CIA chief, the key is our historical and ongoing foreign policy. Listen closely. We're not talking about Monroe Doctrine here. We're talking about something very dark. Very dark and very nefarious. And it's full of betrayal. It's full of lies. It's full of murder and intrigue. And Unfortunately, the White House is all wrapped up in the middle of it. In fact, they're probably the head of it. For decades, and you know this, for decades, the U.S. has backed terrorists for geopolitical ends. In other words, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. For decades, the U.S. has backed the most radical, the most crazy, fundamentalist, violent Muslims. We've done it all the way back to Osama bin Laden. We backed him in the battle against Iraq and Iran. And then we went and hunted him down and shot him in the face and dumped him at sea. The U.S. government has been consistently planning regime change in Syria, Libya, and Iran for more than 20 years. And they've dreamed of regime change, using false flag terror for 50 years. Obama has simply repackaged Bush and the neocons' war on terror as a series of humanitarian wars. Liberals rightfully lambast Bush for getting us into this disastrous Iraq war, but Obama has in fact launched wars in Libya, Syria, Yemen, Pakistan, and up to 35 African nations. Obama, citing a Nixon administration official's justification for invading Cambodia, has claimed his power extends into every country in the world, well beyond those where we are engaged in hostilities openly. Because after all, we have drones now. We have HARP. We have other things. We have satellites. Obama has dramatically escalated the use of drone and assassinations, which are creating many more terrorists than they are killing. The former chief military prosecutor at Guantanamo says that Obama's drone surge is as damning and damaging to our country as Bush's torture program. I think he's actually underestimating damage from the program, as drones have become the number one recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda, especially since children are now being targeted for drone assassination. Oh, we might call it collateral damage, yes, and it is a dastardly thing for Al-Qaeda to set up their headquarters in the kindergarten room next to the third grade at the elementary school, and when we take them out, children are lost. A lot more children than were lost at Sandy Hook. Oh, and torture is still happening on Obama's watch. And the Obama administration has probably supported even more terrorists. I don't mean fighting them. I don't mean assassinating them. I mean giving them money, giving them weapons, giving them cover, and killing the Americans who might leak this to the press. In other words, both GOP and Democrat politicians are supporting destability, terrorism, and war. Those are the deeper truths regarding Benghazi. And now you know how deep the rabbit hole goes. Let's take a break, back away from this, get yourself something comfortable to drink, and let's change the subject. We'll be right back after this.
She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke
X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you not far away from where the Coca-Cola 600 is being run at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. It's been a lead change that's under caution right now. 95 laps to go. It is a long and grueling race, a test of driver, a test of machine, and a test of pit crew. It's one of the more amazing, I think, technological feats where men and women can run on the ragged edge of the loss of control around a track for almost 4 hours. It's really something amazing. I know it's Memorial Day weekend. We don't have a lot of live listeners tonight, and I understand that. Many of you will be listening to the archive, and I want you to tell your friends about this because the last hour covering the Benghazi, the truth behind Benghazi, what's going on there, why that happened and who was behind it and the motivations for it, because you're seeing it unfold right now in the news, but you may not learn the truth of it through the news. We don't really have investigative reporting like we have had in the past. And now with the threat of literally reporters like Mr. Rosen being investigated as co-conspirators for reporting the truth, it's putting a heavy chill on what you're actually going to be able to hear, because the sources in the government are going to dry up because they know that the Justice Department is going to come after them. And even if they don't convict them, they're going to make life miserable for them. And it's going to be interesting to see whether the news organizations stand behind their people and whether they allow them and compensate them for the legal fight that they're about to go through to try to defend their lifelong dedication toward reporting the truth and investigating what's really going on. Because there's really something going on. You know, we're not making news out of nothing. This is very powerful stuff. But I want you to tell your friends about it. Get them in there to sign up for those archives. It helps us keep the lights on here at X Squared Radio. I don't make any money on X Squared Radio. The only thing it does is pay for the web presence and pay for the airtime. I do it because I'm concerned about America. I'm concerned about the freedom and the liberty that we have in this world. I'm trying to do my best to help preserve it. And I'm also trying to keep you informed on the mystery of the universe and of the earth. And it seems lately that the mysteries here on the earth are the most fascinating and the most important to tell you about. So I appreciate your sticking with me tonight. Most of you that are listening live are riveted, and as am I. But I have to tell you, my heart's a little broken. This is not the America that I knew. It's not the America I served when I went into the Air Force. It's not the Constitution that I believe is one of the most inspired documents that ever established a government on this planet. Could be used on any world if it were upheld. We have stopped becoming, we have stopped being a nation that lives by the rule of law, and now we're just living by the rule. And so my heart's a little broken, it's a little tender right now, and I appreciate your patience with me. This hour I was going to cover a piece on the Gosnell trial, which had to do with the billion-dollar butchery of abortion. But I just can't do it. I'm gonna pass up this piece, because if I go through this, I'm just literally not going to make it. I was president of Tennessee Right to Life for a while. It was the largest chapter in the entire state. I know what abortion is about, and you do too. It is about money. And to see what we are struggling with in the press on this story just breaks my heart, because we should not be struggling with it. We should be reporting it, and I just can't do it. Let's go ahead and take a call. Mark from Albuquerque, welcome to the program. How are you, my friend?
Thank you very much, Dr. Agnew. I had to call in. You're breaking my heart, and I need to try to help you and the listeners.
Okay, I could use your help right now.
First of all, you know what? You know, you call for, you ask for people's opinions, and I'll give you my view of it. Everything you've talked about in the first 2 hours is connected.
Sure is.
Okay, and the truth of the matter is, as far as the gold and what's going on with that,
yeah,
that has to occur in order so that the power is not in the hands of those who are doing the things that followed. Do you get that?
I get that. I get that. Sure.
You know, and yes, it's going to be the unknown. It's going to be upsetting. Majorly.
Well, what really breaks my heart is that we know, and we are tying together the shenanigans of the banksters, how they have stolen the gold, they've stolen the value of this planet, and then they fight wars between the power centers of various civilizations. You know, Syria is the ancient power center. They say so goes Egypt, so goes the Middle East. That's not really true. Egypt is kind of a non-issue. Syria, however, is at the center of everything because it's the tribal royal place of power for the Middle East. You know, the Sunni that control that are in the minority, and they're supported by Iran. Whereas Saudi Arabia, the money behind it, trying to take it apart, is behind the gold, the money, the oil, and what in the world are they trying to do? It's so easy to see. But how do you stop it?
And you can't. The thing is, it has a momentum of its own, and there's a reason it has that momentum. That's the thing about it. I mean, it's, you know, back to the word apocalypse. And people call it, you know, think it's the end of the world, and you know that what it means is everything brought to light. When everything's brought to light, you see a lot of crap. You have to see the crap. It's been hidden. We've ignored it. We've done everything we can to go down the merry road and say, oh, well, everything's fine, and we're okay, blah, blah, blah. But that has to come out.
Well, that's not really the way it's been, though. What it is, most people say, no, everything's not fine, but that's over there.
Right.
And I'm over here. I have my job, and I get paid every Friday, and I'm trying to put away a little bit of money and pay my house off, put my kids through college. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to do that gig. But if the people stay asleep out here, it is going to allow this to go down, and they will have nothing.
I know. Well, nothing that seems that isn't what is of importance to them now, as consumers, constant consumers of the latest gigaw, the latest electronic, the latest this, the latest that. It will be the uncomfortable realization that if you can get what you need to exist, you are blessed. And that is what it kind of has to come down to. Because
I agree with that.
But most people are not too comfortable.
But most people are not happy with what they need to exist.
Well, I understand that. I understand. I'm not saying that it's the greatest thing to come along, but it's part of what has to happen for the change to occur that you're thinking of, where we're not going all the stuff of going to other places and overthrowing them and so that the people with money make more money and the people at home send their sons and daughters for the good of the country, for flag and country, because we need to uphold the good when it's illusion. It's an illusion. Yes, that's what's in their hearts. That's what they want to do. I want to help people. Killing, to stop killing, to stop killing is not and never will working.
Yeah, and then there's the other grand deception, and that is that most of the armed forces is made up of local hometown boys and girls that joined the National Guard to have a few extra bucks, a couple weekends a month, a couple weeks in the summer, to help tornado victims and earthquake victims and fires, and you know, help with civil unrest and things like that when systems break down. But they're being snatched out of their hometowns and conscribed by the federal government, and they're sent for multiple tours into that bed where they're allowed to kill, but they're not allowed to win. And then they come home and they kill themselves.
Yes, I understand. And I mean it because they see firsthand, they experience firsthand the futility and what, I mean, I could have maybe understood why they nationalized the National Guard back when they did, but it hasn't been necessary for a number of years, but it continues. I had a little bit of hope concerning this, these issues with the what President Obama spoke of the other day about giving up and having Congress take back the power to make war, because they gave it away with the UMFA or whatever it is, the Use of Military Force.
Yeah, the War Powers Act.
Right, which, bottom line, is unconstitutional. It's the responsibility of Congress. It goes to the money. It's in the Constitution. It's the responsibility of Congress. That was given away with the whatever amendment it was that set up the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I'm totally up with that. But
right.
I hear the words. I hear the words behind right. the teleprompter. But I see the actions that he has wars in Libya, Syria, Yemen, Pakistan, 35 African nations. That's way, way more than any president has ever done. And the news, the reporters are saying nothing about this.
Right.
Nothing about this.
It's part of the thing that the money is in control.
I was speaking to a friend of mine the other day who's serving overseas. We were taking care of some things for his family here. And I just asked him, I should not have asked him, Mark, but I just asked him, hey, where are you serving now? I said, oh, I'm stationed in Egypt. It just blew right over me. And then after I got off the phone, I said, Egypt? What do you mean he's stationed in Egypt? We don't have any American troops in Egypt. Mark? We have American troops in Egypt.
Yep. Yeah, you know, it doesn't surprise me. Did I know it for sure? No, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me simply because I have heard the speeches in the House of Representatives talking about the American Empire. I've heard it. People kind of just blow that off. And say, oh yeah, well, you know, we're America, we're great, we're the good guys. That's not what we're supposed to be. It isn't about being an empire.
No, you're right. That's exactly right.
We don't have a democratically representative country.
Yeah,
and we take care of our own, which we don't.
And, no, we don't.
But here's one of the reasons I wanted to call is I and many others have been gathering together.
Uh-huh.
And looking past, I mean, we see all this stuff going on, and we know that it's unsustainable. And what's happening is people are waking up and saying, huh? This is crazy. This is craziness.
It is.
But we're not going to engage in the insanity.
Well, and we disconnect from that, obviously, because we
right,
see
but
the
it's not that you know? We don't see it. It's not that we deny it, but people are waking up all over the world, not just in this country, not just in Europe, everywhere, regular people. You don't hear that it's not about the politicians, you know, and it's not about those that are in power or the supposed power. It's people connecting with people and finding the commonality and finding that we're on one planet and it's the only planet we have. No matter if we go to other planets, if those folks that are more highly evolved don't say, no, straighten your stuff out on your plate, in your home, and then maybe you can come out and visit. But you're not bringing this shit out with you. I'm sorry about the shit. But you're not taking this. You're not expanding that. I mean, people have talked about this planet being in, what do you call it? When you have a disease and they won't let you out, quarantine.
Yeah, quarantine, right.
Okay. As highly evolved as we see ourselves, looking at us from outside, we still are very going to what our bodies resemble and the instincts within those bodies are, we are still very ape-like. And it goes down to, you know, you talked about tribalism.
Or yeah.
You can think of it as troops with the silverback. The protector. I'm in charge. I'm the strongest. I'll kill or I'll beat up anything that comes in. I'll protect you. And the truth is, in very subtle ways, in all our social interactions, that is still there.
Well, that's true. That's true. It is. And maybe people are waking up. Maybe they are seeing it, but it's not showing up at the polling center. And I'm fearful that if we don't do a better job at making the voters aware of what's going on, then in 2014, I'm afraid the pendulum is going to swing all the way and then it's going to fall off the clock. And then we're going to be in real big trouble. Because, you know, the stuff that I have to cover tonight on the IRS, you know, why, you know, the IRS is being used to target enemies of the state. Or should I say enemies of the administration? They used to be used to target enemies of the state. I mean, how do you think we got Al Capone? He didn't come up in a random audit. We went after him on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and the administrations, mostly Democrats, have always used the IRS to go after their political enemies. Clinton did it. Hillary did it. I mean, come on. They all do it. But it has gotten to the point now where it's being discovered and it's being rooted out. And maybe the fact that the IRS is being used as a police force to stop enemies of the president, maybe the fact that it's coming out is a testament that the reporters that kept this quiet for 30 years are now saying, you know, we're not going to haul the president's water anymore. Mm-hmm. And so now it's a scandal.
And it's, once again, I have to say, in order to when it transparency or everything is brought to light, the crap comes out, and more and more is. I mean, when you were leading up to it, I was thinking, okay, I wonder when he's going to get. down to that Benghazi was the CIA station in Libya. And he brought it out.
Well, the point that I wanted to make is that Stevens was the one that brokered the deal to get the missiles to Al-Qaeda to get them through Turkey into Syria. Now, all that's well and good. I mean, that's what ambassadors do from time to time. But the fact that the State Department let him die, they didn't get him out, they didn't back him up, means that Stevens didn't like the deal. And maybe some of those that died there with him, once they saw it go down, they said, wait a minute, we're pumping the weapons to Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is going to go fight Syria? What are we doing? Those same weapons are going to shoot down our planes.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and I'll tell you, I don't know, because I'm not privy to inside information. But it's a possibility. It is a possibility that the deal that was brokered wasn't through the White House.
No, I doubt that very seriously.
It could well, Al-Qaeda was created by the CIA, right?
Sure, it was.
That's pretty much what's, you know. Has the CIA ever deviated from what the political flavor of the moment is?
Well, yeah, they have, because they're bureaucrats. But you know, this administration is different. When a lot of that stuff went on over there, Bush wasn't personally involved in it. He just set the policy and let it go. Bush didn't have a kill list. He didn't have a list of cards that were placed on his desk each day. And then he said, okay, let's kill these 15 guys today. These are the guys we're going to go after.
As far as we know,
Obama personally selects and approves the assassinations himself.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. And what I say there is, we don't know that Bush didn't have a list like that, because that the White House, that was part of the thing with that White House, was nothing got out except for what they wanted to get out.
Well, that's true, and. You know, there were a lot of leaks in that White House too, and they could have been much worse. But there always are, because the press is always asking government officials, "What about this? What about that?" And under conditions of anonymity, they say so. But now there's so much, it's so blatant. It's like, okay, my predecessors did this, I'm going to do it times 10. And you look at the numbers. You know, look at the numbers that make up this difference. We're not talking about hundreds of executive orders. We're talking about thousands of executive orders. We're not talking about dozens of regulations a month. We're talking about thousands of new regulations a month. It's unbelievable how this administration has taken things over.
Right. No defense of that at all. But then look at the gridlock that Congress has been in.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness, but things get done or will get done one way or another, and normally it goes through legislation, and that hasn't been happening. And it's like, thank God that none of this was part of that. But then what do you see is the executive orders, and I don't know what I can't defend it. Obviously, because it's not part of what we understand our representative government is supposed to do. And the biggest thing that breaks my heart is all of this is done in our names. And it's not a thing about politics. It's morality. It's who we are as a people and a nation being represented by bombing children. And
it's time for it to come to an end, I think. It's just time. You know, this IRS scandal has grown by leaps and bounds, and it's got to be terrifying to the administration to see this falling out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have officials now that come in and testify, then claim the fifth and leave. And, either they're stupid, which could very well be they are, even though they were counsel, to realize that they waived their Fifth Amendment rights by coming in and testifying, and then give the Fifth, and then have the gall to stand up and walk out of a congressional hearing like that, is just, it just, the,
yeah.
The
what do you call it? It's just that.
It's
speechless. I understand. I do understand. But the world keeps turning, and we each in our own way do the best we can. And, you know, all I can say, my brother, is still love you. And
I appreciate you, Mark. Thanks so much for calling.
You need to remember that and fill your heart up. And remember that whatever occurs, whether it's good for good or for evil, there's a plan, and it's a grand plan, and we're all a part of it. And it's okay to get mad and do what you can for the best, the highest and best good of all concerned, as you are able to in your own life.
That's part of the plan, and I'm serving my part in the plan, then. I'm not going to give
up. Yes, you are. Yes, you are, my friend. And you're very much appreciated. And since no one was calling, I wanted to call in and let you know someone was listening.
Well, I appreciate you. And you have an excellent Memorial Day weekend. And we'll speak another time.
All right. Take care, my friend, and continue with your program.
Thanks, Mark. We love you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that was my good friend Mark out in Albuquerque. We've gone hiking in the mountains around Albuquerque and been to some events together and shared some good times. It's excellent, excellent friends out there that have been made over the years. So I'll skip over the IRS statement because I don't have enough time on it. But it is it requires a whole hour by itself to get into. As I said before, you know, the IRS was used to capture Al Capone because, as you know, many of his witnesses could not testify because their hearts had suddenly stopped after a bullet went through it. And so the IRS came in and got him for an income tax evasion, and he died in prison. So hopefully many Americans are not dying in prison over their taxes right now. But it's a terrible thing that, you know, conservative organizations or organizations that are trying to do things in energy, trying to do things in communication or in other kinds of breakthrough technologies are suddenly being audited and have found themselves behind a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar eight ball that's just difficult to get around because – I mean, they're thugs. Now the Justice Department's seizure of phone records from the Associated Press and its monitoring of at least Fox News reporter James Rosen are nothing less than just thuggish attempts to criminalize the practice of journalism. We've seen this threat before, although it's never been carried out. Now we're seeing it carried out by the Justice Department, a Justice Department that's being already in contempt of Congress and will be prosecuted and convicted of it when the time comes. As you know, every legal sidestep that can be taken is being taken, and so we probably won't even see this come to a trial this year, maybe even next year. But a free and open inquiry is also the cornerstone of our democracy. We've always known that. That's why we have a free press. That's why we hold our politicians and bureaucrats' feet to the fire. It's a legacy of enlightenment that has found its clearest expression in the First Amendment of our Constitution, and I quote, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press." I eliminated some of the words between law and abridging because I just wanted to make a point. By now, the founders specifically meant political speech. They understood that, especially political speech, even with the checks and balances built into the Constitution, there's still a need for unfettered press to keep an eye on our public servants with access to both state treasure and power. and that an absolute guarantee of freedom of inquiry was vital to that freedom. You remember, it doesn't exist in other countries. Newspapers can be shut down. Reporters can be arrested. Television channels can be turned off. Radio franchises can be revoked. Licenses can be removed, but not in this country. Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech. That's Cato, by the way, a British essayist, Thomas Gordon and John Trenchard. And that was in a 1720 essay that greatly influenced the framers. I quote, "Whoever would overthrow the liberty of the nation must begin by subduing the freedom of speech." In investigating the Associated Press, Rosen and other Fox News personnel, Attorney General Eric Holder's agency has invoked national security and the Espionage Act of 1917. This is a World War I piece of legislation. Justice has filed 6 cases under the World War I era act, more than all other administrations combined. First, note that the leaks they've opted to plumb are the ones detrimental to the president's media image as the scourge of Al-Qaeda and defender of the realm. And in the previous hour, we told you about a very clear, very well-funded, and almost cleaned-up plot to not only fund Al-Qaeda with money, but to feed Al-Qaeda with weapons. Over 400 tons of rockets and missiles and grenades. Second, there's a big difference between actual spies and reporters doing their jobs. In the 1971 Pentagon Papers case, was also an espionage case, by the way, the Supreme Court took no position on the act itself, but they ruled against the Nixon administration's attempt to restrain the New York Times and the Washington Post from publishing the purloined Vietnam War documents. They ruled against them. They let them publish. Said Justice Hugo Black, "Only a free and unrestrained press can effectively expose deception in government." I would like to use that exact same quote in our support for Julian Assange, who has done exactly the same thing. He has leaked the dirt. He didn't do the crimes. He only told the world about the crimes. Are they classified information? Yeah, probably. So what? They're crimes. They were criminal acts of murder, espionage, deception. And Julian Assange published them to the world. Not that any of this seems to matter to this administration, which openly refers to its ideological opponents as enemies. That makes you and me enemies of the state, does it not? Following the tactics outlined by socialist radical Saul Alinsky, the father of community organizing, the Obama governing ethos is one of slander, intimidation, and the burgeoning IRS scandal so vividly illustrates occasional blunt force to keep its enemies demoralized and incapacitated in its pursuit of fundamental transformation. Whether there are still enough self-respecting mainstream reporters and editors willing to fight back, though, is another question. An even bigger question is whether government officials will risk speaking to those self-respecting mainstream reporters on the basis of anonymity, because their phone records and emails can be subpoenaed, can be taken by this administration through its rubber stamp Justice Department. And then the bureaucrats, the very government officials that remain anonymous and yet feed that free nation
expose to the reporters are running the risk of they themselves being found in the Washington Park having committed suicide. Whether there are still enough government reporter or government officials willing to speak to the press is indeed the question. Like them, Obama is a product of elite schools and shares their values. In a world in which reporters and political operatives live and work in the same neighborhoods, vacation together, routinely intermarry, the president is viewed as one of us. Where once they reveled in their status as outsiders, today's media elite are now drawn from the same social class as the people they cover. With David Axelrod, a former Chicago Tribune journalist turned campaign guru, pulling their strings, the media has been loathed to do or say anything against their hero, preferring to applaud the hope rather than investigate the change. It never seems to have occurred to them that they might become targets themselves. And like Ambassador Stevens, once useful in the transaction, now become a liability and are left to die. There are signs that the worms are finally turning, however. The Obama administration has moved beyond protecting government secrets to threatening fundamental freedoms of the press. And of course, the president has issued some pro forma boilerplate in defense of press freedom via his beleaguered press secretary, Jay Carney, himself a former Time magazine reporter. Relying on the government's goodwill, however, isn't enough. In the Nixon years, journalists wore a place on the enemies list as a badge of honor. It's time for reporters to claim and reclaim that badge and start acting like the guardians of liberty they've meant to be. If not for themselves, then for their country, for me, for you, for your children. All right, in finality, you know, the Swiss Federal Institute, that's the SFI in Zurich, released a study very recently entitled The Network of Global Corporate Control, that proves a small consortium of corporations, mainly banks, actually run the world. Yeah, imagine that. A mere 147 corporations, which form a super entity, have control of 40% of the world's wealth, which is the real economy. These mega corporations are at the center of the global economy. The banks found to be the most influential are... These are not in order of size. They're not in alphabetical order. Are you ready? These are the main banks that make up the banksters. If you have money in these banks, you know what to do. Barclays, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase and Company, Vanguard Group, UBS, Deutsche Bank, Bank of New York Mellon Group, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America Corp., and Societe Generale. However, as the connections to the controlling groups are networked throughout the world, they become the catalyst for global financial collapse. James Glatfelder, complex systems theorist at the SFI, explains, in effect, less than 1% of the companies were able to control 40% of the entire network. Using mathematical models normally applied to natural systems, the researchers analyzed the world's economy. Their data was taken from Orbis 2007, a database which lists 37 million corporations and investors. The evidence showed that the world's largest corporations are interconnected to all other companies and their professional decisions affect all markets across the globe. George Sudhara, complex systems expert for SFI, claims that this phenomena is a common structure that could be found in nature. Comparing the manufactured reality of the financial markets to the ecosystems of the planet, Sudhara says that although the 147 corporations that rule the world through influence and interconnectedness are no more harmful than the natural cycles of our weather or animal kingdoms, yet, because of the facts presented in the study, the financial crash of 2008 can be traced back to these tightly knit networks. Go figure. Future disasters can also be projected based on this analysis because of the connectedness of these influential entities, which are only 147 corporations. It is suggested that global capitalism could be a useful tool to make the markets more stable by simply acquiescing to control by the technocrats. But they won't. The world's transitional corporations guide the flow of all economies through influence and manipulation, which creates a structure of economic power. Most corporations are guided by the shareholders who use the companies to wield incredible power over the shift of economic consciousness. And the behavior of the system reflects the direction taken by those who fund the super entities. Assumed by many that there was a complex architecture to the global economic power that caused financial system to ebb and flow or to crash and burn as a matter of nature, sort of uncontrollable without any one person or any one group in control, is not a scientific fact as evidenced in this study. As the banking cartels force countries in the Eurozone into sovereign debt, there is a weakening of the many multinational corporations around the world. Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase have financially gained while stocks are being unloaded in other markets. This sovereign land grab by the central banking cartels across Europe is mirrored in a recent Goldman Sachs report. The more the Spanish administration indulges domestic political interests, the more explicit conditionality is likely to be demanded. In other words, the technocrats working for the Zionists are acquiring each country in the Eurozone. They're buying it up. The European central bankers agreed to give any nation in the Eurozone a bailout if they agreed to hand over the country to them under the guise of new rules and conditions when applying for assistance. In other words, if things go south and you go broke, your country is the collateral. As America drifts downstream toward economic implosion, guess what? The Federal Reserve, headed by Ben Bernanke, appointed by President Obama, has chosen a different approach. They unveiled Quantitative Easing 3 as a pump-and-dump scheme to prop up the U.S. dollar by printing cash, about $40 to $80 billion a month, that is backed by, you guessed it, nothing, nada, zippo, while purchasing the mortgage-backed securities from the same banks that created the scandal and acquiring land in a massive land grab for pennies on the dollar, the likes of which have never been seen in the U.S. Now, while that's going on, Brazil, Russia, India, and China are buying their gold back. They're buying it to back their fiat currencies to avoid being caught up in the destruction of the technocrats as they march toward one world currency. Because as you know, if the paper collapses, the metal is going to hold it up. The metal is going to hold up these countries. Now, these four countries, also known as BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, have become the antithesis to the banking cartels of the Zionist regime. And I'm using that word broadly, okay? I don't mean to be anti-Semitism. I don't want to express that. The fact that one nationality seems to control the banks is merely a coincidence. As these nations pair with Middle Eastern countries like Iran to trade gold for oil instead of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, the Obama administration has begun a propaganda campaign against China involving a manufactured cyber threat. You've heard about it, haven't you? In the press, have you not heard that China is breaking into this cyber account or doing this cyber attack? Hardly a week goes by that you don't hear about it. And they even nail down the building in Shanghai where it comes from. And within hours, China comes back and says, this is a complete fabrication. We're not doing it. Nothing like that is happening. The truth is the Obama administration is manufacturing that as a propaganda campaign. In Iran, the terrorist factions that do the bidding of the Zionists to topple governments by inciting fake revolutions have been deployed to Iran to stir up trouble and blame the failing Ra'il, which is being strategically destroyed by sanctions placed on the nation by guess who? The U.S. The American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee coerced the U.S. Congress to pass H.R. 1905, which further tightened the economic noose around Iran for the benefit of the Zionist-controlled Israeli government. There, I said it. I can't help it. In April of this year, the BRIC nations met to agree upon a strategy that would liberate the countries of the world from the grip of the technocrats. In other words, they're trying to stop the fiat crash of the currencies. Remember, they're printing dollars and yen as fast as the printing press will run, as fast as they can get those wads of billions of their currencies down the throats of their economic systems. They're pushing it down there with a plunger. The BRIC countries are pushing for peace, but not through force and occupation of other countries to obtain this goal. Remember, China has invaded no one. China is at war with no one. Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, had this to say about the United Nations and their obvious attempts at global governance through usurpation of powers over countries. He says, one of the priorities of the BRICS, that's Brazil, Russia, Iran, China, for the years to come, should be the strengthening and key role of the UN Security Council in maintaining international peace and security. Okay? I'm sorry, India and China, not Iran. BRIC. While the global elites still hold power over the G5 countries, the rest of the world is standing up, and they're severing their ties and making plans for a new world without them. That's why China, India, Russia, and Brazil are buying gold by the ton if they can take delivery. And maybe that's why Germany has been delayed for 7 years from getting their 300 tons. So that's how it goes, world politics. And by the way, I have a lot more. I've got so much more notes tonight. Anybody who's listening tonight that would like a copy of my working notes for tonight, I have about 4.5 hours of content. There was so much to go over tonight, you cannot believe. Please write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll be happy to send it to you. May you enjoy this Memorial Day weekend. Celebrate tomorrow. Overeat, overdrink. You can recover tomorrow night. Just do this. Remember those that have paid the ultimate price, and especially those that have almost paid the ultimate price. They're still with us. Most of their body is still with us. Remember them, and remember this. It wasn't their politics. It wasn't their ideology. It was their patriotism through which they answered the call and they went. Were they supporting our freedom? It's difficult to say. But they were supporting the rule of government, and for them, all you that have served. I served during the Vietnam era and got out without a scratch, but those of you that have paid the price, I salute you. Have an excellent week. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.